The agenda is before you, honorable members. But I thought that before we start with the discussion on the selection criteria, let's start with the apologies. Are there any apologies? Honorable Swart? Your apologies noted, Honourable Breitenbach.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm apologizing both of Mr. Self. He's still recovering from surgery. Thank you.
Our prayers are with him. Yes. Is he around Cape Town or?
Yes, he's in Cape Town, but he's at home.
Okay.
He has come to Parliament on the odd occasion, but that's not been good for him, and so he's then deteriorated. So his doctor has now insisted that he stay at home.
Okay. Well, we wish him a speedy recovery. Any further apologies?
Thank you, Chair. Honourable Mofokeng has got another meeting, but she will try her best to still join us. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Honourable members, I think you have all been receiving letters of complaint with regard to the head of the SIU, Advocate Motsebe, and I think we received a lot of letters after the appearance of the SIU before the committee, and Parliament cannot be seen to be ignoring such complaints. I propose, honourable members, that this matter be referred as a matter of urgency to the minister to investigate and deal with the matter and report to the committee urgently. Possibly when we come back early next year, we will request him to update the committee on the actions that he would have taken to deal with the matter, but we think that the matter should be dealt with expeditiously, to look at the veracity of all the allegations that are made and to take appropriate steps to deal with the matter. SIU is very important in the fight against corruption and good governance. We can't afford it being destabilized. Honorable Hisham, noted Honorable Nola, Honorable Swart, okay, and then Honorable Mulaute.
No, thank you very much, Chairperson. I want to fully endorse your proposition to the committee in that that the matter be dealt with procedurally correct. As we know, the SIU at the end of the day is answerable to the executive, and the executive needs to be seized to attend to the complaint itself, so that we as Parliament is able to respond to the complainants once we received, as you indicated, the response from the minister in particular. In that way, I think we'll be procedurally correct in this instance, and also so that we don't venture in areas where we don't have capacity to at this stage. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Chair, I move to second and support what you have just proposed with regard to the debacle revolving the head of SIU. But well, the matter has been going on in a cold and hot form for quite some time. I think it will be proper for us to have unambiguous time frames. And that, let's say, if we are to say the first thing when we open in the 2020 year, we say in the first week, let us have a meeting with the department solely to discuss and pave the way forward on the matter at hand. Thank you very much, Chair.
Thank you, Honourable Ngola. Honourable Swart.
Chair, we also support your recommendation and we support your sentiment that the SIU is a very important institution, particularly now given the special tribunal that has been set up and the need to recover ill-gotten gains dealing with corruption and investigations. So we support that investigation, but we do need to exercise our oversight continually and to ensure that it is done expeditiously so that we can get a feedback as soon as possible. Thank you, Chair.
Followed by Honourable Breitenbach. Oh, sorry. Okay, will be the last one, Honourable Jale.
Thanks, Chairperson. I also support in this account your recommendations that the Parliament must act, more especially because on the allegation they are abusive women, and also the allegation that he lied to Parliament on his presentation. So we need to refer this to the political head, the minister, whom he must account to us because it's the entity under his leadership, political leadership. So we will appreciate that you must expedite that we must see solving that, and the secretary of the committee must respond as such that the committee is taking this action, so that the people who are sending the message, they must see Parliament acting, not maybe if they see us not doing anything, they might end up writing to the Speaker straight. So let's respond that we acknowledge their concern, however we're entertaining them to the relevant level. Thank you.
Honourable Mlaotse, Honourable Breitenbach.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We support the fact that the committee will take some action. We should just let the complainant know what the steps are that we have taken, and we support the suggestion. Thank you.
Honourable Jale.
Thank you, Chairperson. I support the move, and also the issue of the time frame. If I hear you clearly, Chairperson, you are saying when we come back January, we want the result in terms of the action that has been taken. So does it mean from today, as we are handing it over to the minister, he must begin to work? He must start working, and we want those the results in terms of saying this is what he has done. I think I also support Honourable Mlaotse when he says we need to respond to the complainant. The minister must respond and acknowledge that you have received the complaint and we are doing something. Thank you, Chair.
Very much. So we agree that first week of January, when we come back, we're expecting an update on the action that would have been taken by the minister. Thank you very much, honorable members, for the guidance. We will act accordingly. Item number three, Ms. Silkstone, on the selection criteria.
Good morning. I was asked to prepare a document just looking at some of the criteria that the committee could bear in mind when they go about shortlisting and then obviously interviewing as well the Deputy Public Protector. So just to give you an update, we received 29 applications or nominations, of which three candidates withdrew, so we have 26 in total. And then on page three, I'm going to go through, and if you need me to stop and explain aside a little bit more, then just let me know. So,
Honourable Stilstone,
yes.
Can you speak directly to your mic?
Sorry. Okay, so...
Because you are presenting today, we'll call you Honourable.
So the Act sets out the essential qualifications. So these are your minimum criteria for appointment. So the person who is appointed Deputy Public Protector must be a South African citizen and who is fit and proper to hold the office. And then the minimum criteria for appointment for the qualifications are that the person has either practiced as an attorney or advocate for a period of at least 10 years, is qualified to be admitted and has lectured and has lectured in law at a university for at least 10 years. So we're looking at a legal qualification and then also academic experience in law, has specialized knowledge of or experience in the administration of justice, public administration or public finance, again for at least 10 years, an MP for at least 10 years, and have any combination of experience mentioned above for at least 10 years. So when we talk about the 10 years, it doesn't need to be a solid 10 years, it just needs to be cumulative. So if we're going to move beyond the essential criteria, Corruption Watch has done a very useful survey. They did a survey when we were going about appointing the Public Protector in 2016, which was also very useful. The online survey had a total of 359 respondents, and just to say that although the survey was random, it does not claim to be representative or demographically representative. So in terms of qualifications, it was found that 74 of the respondents felt that being a practicing attorney or advocate with at least 10 years of experience was the most important qualification. 69% felt that specialized knowledge of or experience in the administration of justice, public administration or public finance was also very important. And 60% of the respondents ranked being an MP the least important. Interestingly, when you look at the 2016 survey around the public protector, that was also regarded as the least important qualification. In terms of experience, 75% believed that adequate legal experience, and 71% believed that investigative experience were a necessity for the candidate. And then experience in the social justice sector was regarded as important by 57% of respondents. In terms of skills, the skills that an ideal candidate should have are investigative and analytical, communication skills, and leadership skills. Then in terms of values, the candidate should have integrity, accountability, honesty, respect for the rule of law, be accountable, objectivity, and be an independent person. Then looking at how the courts have described the public protector, and the reason why I've drawn a comparison between the Deputy Public Protector and the Public Protector is that the DPP will act as Public Protector when the Public Protector is not available, and also should the Public Protector's office be vacant. So the court has described the Public Protector as independent, impartial, capable of exercising powers without fear, favour or prejudice. That those come directly from the Constitution. Courageous, vigilant, have conviction of purpose, not a passive adjudicator between citizens, has a proactive function, have an open and inquiring mind, be dignified, be beyond reproach, a person of stature, suitably qualified, and an anti-corruption champion. So that is quite a lot that we expect from our public protector. So let's just put all of this into like a little matrix. So in terms of character, we're looking at things like independence, impartiality, the ability to perform functions without fear, favor, or prejudice, integrity, and honesty. In terms of experience, we're looking at legal, investigative, analytical knowledge of public institutions, public finance, and experience in the social justice sector. Then in terms of actual knowledge, good governance, and understanding of the social justice system, so we expect people to be in touch with what's happening within the society. Have knowledge of the guiding legislation and constitution, have knowledge of investigations and be analytical, and knowledge of public finance. In terms of skills, leadership skills, communication, and investigative and analytical skills, as well as conflict resolution skills. And then just some further thoughts, and I haven't ranked this in any particular order. Questions that you can ask is, does the candidate display the necessary values for the job? Is the candidate a person of integrity and honesty? Does the candidate display the necessary passion and motivation for the position? This is a very demanding position. Is the candidate knowledgeable? Is the candidate technically experienced? Does the candidate have the necessary skills for the position, and is the candidate experienced with regard to the value and needs of our society? Thank you.
Thank you very much, honorable members. That is the presentation with regard to the criteria that it's proposed we should be looking at in appointing the Deputy Public Protector. Are there any views, comments on the criteria? Honorable Hisham, Honorable Jail, Honorable Mola, Honorable Horn, Honorable Mulauzi, in that order.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you very much for the presentation. We appreciate the work done by the Secretariat, and we note, of course, Section 2A4 of the Public Protector Act and the qualifying fit and proper criteria. But Chair, just before we get into the, I'm sure members will elaborate on the criteria, there's some questions around the applicants received. If we can just get a more breakdown to that effect, so we have a better idea. As I understood, 29 applications or submissions or nominations were received, and maybe missed it. How many of these do qualify against the criteria in the ad itself? Just a clear breakdown, and whether there's any in relation to that for this committee to consider today as far as that is concerned. Secondly, Chair, the issues that we need to look at, the number of, besides the essential qualifications that we have to look at with regard to the criteria we want to list down as a committee, taking into account, of course, a number of submissions we have received. I don't know whether we will get more information on that, but basically I'm referring to the type of skills, the experience, etc. The rest, of course, is already listed there. And then also take into account, I think we need to look at, and we'll elaborate later, I have another chance, I'm sure colleagues will do, but that is the minimum standard set by our court judgments when elaborating its understanding of the bare essentials of what a public protector and deputy public protector must have in terms of their proactive function in particular when it comes to values. And because we all know that the deputy public protector will be acting in the public protector's place in absentia, will be called to that effect in terms of the act. We also know that there are particular delegations on a day-to-day basis that the deputy public protector is expected of to perform on a daily basis. Then, Chair, I'm in support of the list of characteristics, or rather the criteria put there with on the character. I'm not going to go in it, it's in front of us, the experience, the knowledge and the skills base. I don't have a problem with that thing as well articulated there. Some of it do come from some of the judgments we've read. But I would want to, I don't know whether now or later, would want to come in into the applications in terms of the numbers. But let me propose, one, that we at least today decide on the criteria as listed. Two, that we set against that criteria, we decide on the number of candidates that needs to be shortlisted, depending on the information I've asked earlier. And three, that we decide on perhaps an unstructured type of the type of interviews we're going to structure for the day or 2 days, whatever we decide, depending on the amount of the number of applicants we shortlist. And four, that we also look at the vetting process. And in that regard, given the status of this particular level of this responsibility, that we ask SSA to complete that for us. And lastly, that we set some kind of dates. But I know we the second part of our exercise won't be today. That would be the actual shortlisting. I think it was. We said Thursday, tomorrow, yeah. So that's still in the making. But at least we do those four things. Thanks, Chair.
Thank you, Chairperson. We welcome the presentation and also the work done by our staff members to assist us also in some other things in making sure that we have this information, Chair. Chairperson, I see here we've got the 29 applicants, and we also have been given those who are qualifying, how many, and then put together with their experiences. In line with the suggestion of Honorable Mohammed on the issue of vetting, Chairperson, I would propose that our vetting, if it's possible, if time won't be against us, our vetting should start from the beginning, with those that would have the number that after we have taken out, maybe those who are not shortlisted, yes, taken out those who are not qualifying and shortlisted, vetting should start there, so that we don't find ourselves wasting time. We shortlist a certain number, and then from there we So if we can start, everybody must be vetted. And then also on this issue of the essential, on the issue of the absence of when the work of the DPP taking over in the public protectors absentia, I'm not sure if maybe Chairperson, I will be asking too much if I say, is it not maybe I don't want to say wise, for better of lack, better of some weight that I can use now, won't it be maybe wise that we also formalize that delegation, delegated work that would have been given to the DPP whilst the public protector is there? Because I don't think that it is proper that he will only work when the public protector is not there and the public protector decides on whatever delegated work that he would give daily. Maybe if you can also be given, you know, insight as to what are those delegated or responsibility that will be given to him, though we know maybe they, let's take only those that we think will be core in terms of making sure that he become active also whilst the public protector is there. Thank you, Chairperson.
Honorable Ngwala.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Chair, I think it would be important for us to remind ourselves that we are presiding over a matter that belongs to society. This matter that we are presiding over is a matter that actually has attracted even the public interest. That's why we have opened the matter to the public for it to have commentary even on the applicants that have applied in terms of what we have dispatched as an advert. The report says that there are a number of some applicants who withdrew, whether from being nominated or having applied. We have a number of six candidates who does not qualify in terms of the basic qualifications we have set in issuing up the advert. I'm not quite sure, Chair, because we have taken the list of the applicants and candidates to society, and then we made them public for access and commentary from society. I'm not sure if it won't be prudent for us to make it known as well that this number of candidates, I mean, these are candidates that have withdrawn. These are candidates that have do not actually meet the minimum requirements. I'm saying, Chair, I'm not sure. I'm subject for an advice by committee members with regard to that. But Chair, I think my colleagues have covered me in a way in that what has been presented to us as work done by the committee secretariat must be a document that must help us in trying to select amongst those who have applied. The number of features that have been mentioned here of what kind of a deputy public protector are we looking for in South Africa? I think what has been said here must be our measuring tool in terms of the selection process, which was supposed to determine. Chair, we have set a committee meeting where we agreed that the vetting part must be done to those who have been selected, in that to use time appropriately that we don't have. We need not to vet everyone who has just been a candidate or an applicant into the process. We have a decision into that effect. So I think as soon as we resume the selection for interviews, let us immediately do the vetting to those that which we have specifically selected for the interviews, Chair. I think the time frames to when and how do we move with the issues of selection, I'm sure, Chair, we have to await the vetting report on when then do we resume the process of interviewing those candidates, having had the actual report on vetting. But I think, Chair, it must be noted officially in the committee that this matter is very urgent. We are running short of time. We are left with 30 plus minus days to the dot where the actual contract of the DPP expires. So I think, Chair, it must be treated, even the issue of vetting must be treated with high forms of agency so that we're able to be quick and meet the deadline, because we have a deadline to ensure that we have concluded this matter. Thank you very much, Chair.
Thank you. Honorable Ngola, Honorable Horn.
Thank you, Chair. Firstly, thank you for the presentation. I think that it assists. I would, however, suggest, Chair, that there's one or two issues that, in terms of criteria, we must go beyond just stating the obvious by way of the suggested criteria in terms of the presentation. So, for example, whilst the experience and the academic qualifications, I think if one looks back at the Act, we can agree that the aim is to give the Office of the Public Protector somebody who should be able to have a proper understanding of the role and functions of the office. But unfortunately, I think in the times we live in, given the fact that you may have the relevant experience or academic qualifications, does not necessarily constitute a proper understanding of the role and functions of the office. So I would suggest that we add that as a separate criteria to be canvassed with those shortlisted, at least. And in addition to that, also, because...
Can you just repeat the issue of the last sentence?
No, that we add as something to be canvassed during the interviews of those shortlisted, that the preferred candidate should have a proper understanding of the role and functions of the Office of the Public Protector. And in addition to that, but also I think very importantly, one would expect somebody with 10 years legal experience or experience in the administration of justice, etc., and even somebody who's had a, not necessarily maybe, 10 years experience as a member of parliament, to have that investigative and analytical capacity. But in addition to that, what is also very important is an ability to properly interpret the law and apply it to the facts found during an investigation. And I think in addition to a proper understanding of the role and functions, that's also something we should zoom into during the interviews, and not just accept that everybody who holds an LLB degree and has some experience of 10 years necessarily in these days have the ability to properly interpret the law and to apply it to a set of facts. Then my last input, Chair, is in respect of the vetting. So I think we must just, as a committee, and maybe I'm the one who's not clear, and then I must be cleared up, have a proper understanding of what we mean with this vetting. So, and why I'm saying this is the experience during the ad hoc committee who dealt with the interviews of the public protector, where the ad hoc committee at some stage were just confronted with a letter placed in front of all of us indicating that the current deputy public protector, and we all know the story, do not qualify for top secret clearance. Now, to my mind, that's not necessarily what vetting entails. Vetting obviously should assist us, and to an extent, I think Corruption Watch has done a lot of vetting to try and find out whether everybody was really truthful and whether there is other relevant factors regarding candidates that must be taken into account. But then in addition to that, I think we as a committee must have a proper understanding in the final instance as to whether it is really a requirement. It's not in the Act that the Deputy Public Protector must have or qualify for this top secret accreditation or whatever from SSA. I've said it before and I'm going to repeat it. If you look at the mandate of the Public Protector, which is maladministration, then really state security and state secrets should not be threatened by an investigation into maladministration at all. Maladministration can never be justified on the basis that in the subjective view of state security agencies, the security of state or the considerations relevant to the security of the state is at play. But if that is the case, then we must know it. But from where I'm sitting, I'm still not quite sure. We hear from the current Public Protector that's one of the reasons why her current deputy, who is vacating office, has not been involved with sensitive or investigations of a public nature, high-profile investigations. But I'm, with the greatest of respect, still not convinced. So I think, if necessary, we as a committee must be advised properly as to what the requirements in respect of security clearance really is. Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Mulaus.
Thanks, Chairperson, and let me appreciate the Secretariat to arrange this preview selective criteria. So, Section 24(4) of the Public Protector Act clearly stipulates what must be followed. When you check Section 24(4), bullet number, at the last bullet, which talks about having any combination of experience mentioned above for 10 years experience. So I just want to know how many of such people, I think it's 26, do they qualify this criteria of combination of experience of the above? How many of them? And secondly, you said on your second page there is a one in addition, in the case one candidate is unclear whether the criteria are met. So what caused you not to be sure? Because the Section 24 stipulate what must be your baseline to check whether a person can qualify or not. When you said whether it is unclear, why are you saying it's unclear? What is that? So thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you. Honorable Horn, just if you can advise us, I'm not saying you're wrong, but I think how are we going to go about establishing that the ability to properly interpret the law to the set of facts, if you can just, so that I think she will be in a position also to respond.
I think that's something I would just advise we add to the criteria, and it's again something that has to be canvassed during the interviews, quite possibly, by asking of candidates whether they, quite possibly we can ask them in preparation for the interviews even, to prepare themselves to address the committee on how their investigative and experiences has played out in the past. I'm not suggesting for one moment that we give them a mock set of facts and ask them to, but that we possibly, once we've decided who we shortlist, as part of the guidance in preparing and in preparation ask of candidates to also address this committee on how they in practical terms in the past have interpreted the law and applied it to a set of facts they found during an investigation.
Thank you. Honorable Hisham.
Yeah, just in response to even the committee, what Honorable Horn was referring to about the top secret issue, the Act doesn't necessarily refer, is right, and I support his proposal. But let me come to the vetting.
Can you speak directly to the mic?
Sorry. When it comes to the vetting and the level of vetting, we must remember public interest and national interests are very important in the functioning of the public protector and the deputy public protector. We know the aim, or rather the functionality, as pointed out, largely is investigative, and certain functions are delegated to the deputy public protector on a daily basis. In that course, the deputy public protector deals also with the type of documents that affect the very investigation, meaning people must have confidence that their submissions will be handled with all the necessary decorum in protecting their dignity, their security, and that should not be confused with the transparent process of a particular investigation or finding of the public protector. So when it comes to, there needs to be a degree of level of vetting that is required, and lastly, it's the best qualified people to do that is by what I based on. So I think while it's not there in the Act, it's very much required for an office such as, especially when it's investigative nature, that requires vetting, most definitely. And that's, I would suggest that would be a minimum expectation, if not logic expectation, on a rationality that public would expect that to have. And we should actually stipulate it right there. Yeah. Thanks, Chair.
Honorable Breitenbach, Honorable Horn, and Honorable Gola.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The Act is very clear. There's no requirement for a top secret clearance. The type of work that the public protector does is has very little to do with national security in the normal course. In the extraordinary circumstances in which we find ourselves today, where the government has stolen the country blind, that may be an issue, but in the general course of the public protector's business, that should not be an issue. And the general run of the whole work that the public protector does should not have very much to do with national security. She investigates for the people. And we all know that state security is way behind in their vetting. I'm quite sure that if it was possible to do a study of how many people at the Public Protector's Office in fact have security clearance at the moment, today as we speak, you'd find that there are many who don't have anything because state security just can't keep up with the demand. I'm quite sure that if you go and have a look at the police, many police officers who deal with very sensitive investigations have no security clearance because state security cannot keep up with the demand. And I know for a fact that most of the prosecutors who deal with sensitive information have no security clearance or what's left because state security cannot keep up with the demand. So I'm not sure how we're going to deal with this issue of vetting and how we will rely on the vetting done by state security. State security doesn't even have a committee in this parliament that has oversight over them. They've got a reputation that has been ruined. Why we should trust them, I don't know. And so this whole issue of security betting becomes almost impossible to deal with. So it's an issue, and if we're going to push for the Deputy Public Protector to have top secret security betting before we look at them, we may have to postpone this whole process to 10 years from now to give state security time to get their house in order and catch up with the backlog. So it's an issue, and I don't know how we're going to... But there's no such requirement in the Act. And so we can't impose a requirement that doesn't exist in the Act. It's not within our competence to do so.
Yeah, thanks, Chair. I don't want to make more of this than it should be, but I just feel it's important to respond to what the submission by the Honourable Mohammed in response to my submission. And I must say I get a little bit worried when words like public interest and national interest are being used in relation to this whole exercise and the functions of the Office of the Public Protector. Ultimately, if we cut it to the bone, the public obviously have a direct interest in the rooting out of maladministration and corruption, which is the core function of this of the Public Protector, along with policing the Executive Members Ethics Act, which is not unrelated. So I just want to urge that we be very careful not to read into the role and functions of the Public Protector, that in performing those duties and functions, that office has a balancing duty to rather protect what is called a national interest, because then we will seriously erode what is supposed to be the Office of the Public Protector.
Honorable.
Thank you very much, sir. I'd wish to make a comment on two things. The issue of vetting and qualifying to be exposed to top secret issues of the country. Chair, I think part of what was discussed here after the presentation was a matter of the actual delegation of authority to the Deputy Public Protector, which I think is one key instrument that can take us to where we want to go, of whether to vet or not to vet. But, Chair, I would wish, as much as this statute is silent with regard to the matter, but as well, if we go for a vetting, you do it for a public interest. You do it for the protection of the state and its people. But equally, you are not, by doing so, contravening what the legislation is saying. That's what I wanted to say, Chair. And I would unequivocally wish to move that all those selected, can they be subjected to vetting? And by doing so, we would not be contravening any law or practice by government of South Africa. Two, Chair, there is an issue regarding which Honorable Hones has put forward of the ability to interpret and apply law. I would agree with Honorable Horn. It is a very correct point, but it is very problematic at the same time. It is problematic, Chair, on the sense that you are putting a criteria of a person who is supposed to qualify to be Deputy Public Protector, which amongst those, you don't really say everyone must have been in the field or the profession of law. You have made a criteria that says a person who is was lecturing in a certain university. Now, the unfair part about it is that you are going to be able to quickly know the ability to apply and interpret law from an advocate. You are not going to be able to do that from a person who merely was a social activist, but qualifying in terms of the criteria we have set here. So I'm saying, Jane, in a nutshell, the ability to interpret and apply law is correct, but it is so unfair and problematic considering the criteria we have set there. I'm following the question, Chair, on how do we go about establishing whether a candidate is able to apply an inappropriate law when you have this nature of the criteria. So, Chair, I just wanted to say those two issues. Thank you.
Honorable Jale.
Person, I think I'm covered by Comrade Honorable Kola. The only thing that I want to emphasize, Chairperson, my colleagues there in DA, they are the first one, Chairperson, to shout when there is somebody hired and that person become, you find that later there are some skeleton in terms of his own life that maybe he did some corruption. So when we want to do things right, we want to make sure that we are doing things correct and everybody that will be undergoing this process would have been checked, Chairperson. I don't see why we can't allow that, because we want to make sure that we don't, at the end, we come back here and say this DPP was found have been done something somewhere when, and we come back again here and waste time and want to debate the issue of how do we remove him. We don't want to remove anybody in terms of his past of corruption. We want to make sure that everybody must be vetted. I think that has been a move that we said everybody who's going to work in the state working for us must be vetted, so that we don't waste time by removing people. So I insist that let's vet them. We know that it might take time, but we can come up. But Chairperson, let's vet people. Thank you.
Honorable Ngola. Sorry, Honorable Mulauza.
Thank you, Chairperson. I can see here it's like the house is divided in terms of vetting or non-vetting. So I was saying that I'm proposing that where there is a challenge like this, we better follow the law, the legislation. We are members of parliament here to create laws. So if we think vetting is very important, and as such, we must put it, amend the laws and make bills in order to say a public protector or Chapter 9 institution to be appointed must be vetted or not. Vetting is important, but it's not legislated here in this subject matter. So we can't stuck because of the vetting purposes. I want to say that because it's not in the legislation, it also subjected ourselves to be litigations. Because if you didn't, you failed to shortlist someone because as a result of vetting, and that someone get that information, can send you to court and stop everything. Because he will say, you vet me out of which rule or out of which legislation. The most important thing why we have laws and legislation is to avoid to use common sense. In terms of common sense, it's good to vet, but in terms of we don't have such legislation to bind ourselves. So the parliament must be seen operating out of common sense. We're the highest level of government to create laws here. Let's amend the law. If we want to amend the law, let's agree. In this subject matter, we don't have anything to force us to vet, because if it will take us a long time, because the time is against us, because December the Deputy Public Protector is leaving the office. So the vetting can be there as a guidance, but not as a criteria as such, because it's not here on the law. It's not yet a law, it's a common sense, Honorable Ngo.
Chair, can I pose a question?
Just wait before we proceed. I don't think that the argument is about vetting as a criteria to appoint. I think the issue with the Deputy Public Protector, it was about the issue of the delegation by the Public Protector, which did not disqualify him not to be Deputy Public Protector. I think for the purposes of this process, we did the vetting, I think, last time. I think we could proceed with the vetting. That is one. And two, I think it would be important also to note that we will do the selection, and then it is only the people who have been selected. People are not going to be excluded. We are not going to use vetting to exclude people from selection. But it will be part of the process that is going to aid the committee to have enough information about the candidate. But it is not the only, vetting cannot be the only issue that can be used to decide who is a public protector and who is not a public protector.
That's very clear, Chair. Yeah. As a result, I would like to propose that to have an outside discussion with Honorable Mlaut. We must finish up this thing outside. Thank you. You can't say I'm using common sense.
Sorry. I have no authority on the discussions that are happening outside. So I cannot give nor deny discussions that are going to be happening outside, as long as they're not going to be brought back here like what happened last week. Ms. Silkstone?
Let me jump into the pre-screening issue first. At this stage, we don't do a vetting, we do a pre-screening. The pre-screening looks at your criminal record, it looks at your finances, and it looks at your citizenship. So it's a very useful tool because we've had some embarrassing experiences in the past when we used to sort of troll through the internet, but nobody picked up that one of the candidates actually had something that prevented him from being appointed. But then even if a person, for example, had a criminal record, it might be that it doesn't, it might be something that the committee would not want to exclude the person on. For example, when you were considering the candidates for the public protector, one of the candidates had a criminal record, but it was related to his activities activities as an activist opposing apartheid. So, I don't know, Bonani would need to clarify, the questionnaires that were sent out actually give the candidates an opportunity to disclose what they want to bring to the attention of the committee and to provide an explanation. So that would also really be quite helpful. So it's not about excluding somebody necessarily, it's about what are we testing here. We don't want to be embarrassed by information that we don't know. We don't want to have somebody who's been, hasn't been forthcoming, because that obviously says that we've got issues around honesty and integrity. So that's really what the purpose of the pre-screening is. Then in terms of the delegations, the only thing in the Act that says that deals with delegations is Section 3 of the Act, which talks about the Deputy Public Protector assisting the Public Protector. So each Public Protector has delegated differently to their deputy. The present Public Protector had different delegations when Advocate Montenegro was there, and they were changed once the new Public Protector was brought in. The previous Deputy Public Protector also had different delegations. The issue of delegations generally is a problem, and I think it would be quite useful for the committee to ask that the Public Protector lets the committee have a look at the delegations. We obviously can't prescribe to the Public Protector what the delegations are, but we can make comments.
The
then in terms of Mr. Horn's questions or points that he wanted to add, we can certainly look into seeing how we can maybe sort of work those into the interview process. And obviously, you can't, it's not fair if somebody doesn't have that investigative and analytical experience to then hone in on that. There might be something else that they're strong at that also qualifies them. So we would need to have some kind of, when you ask questions, you would need to then, they need to be appropriate for the candidate who's in front of you. And then in terms of the specific questions around candidates, I don't have all that information right in front of me. Can I rather just give you the breakdown tomorrow? I've got, or later today, I know that 6 candidates didn't qualify, so there are about 19 who that 2 do qualify. I think I've covered everything, more or less.
To discuss as a committee is the number of people that needs to be shortlisted. I think that is one, and then 2. The number of days, whether we will do the interview over one day, starting in the morning until, I'm told, I'm advised that you did the same. I'm told that that is what you did last time. But I think we would need to say what were the lessons learned, what can be improved. So that is why we. I think it will be important to discuss a number of days. And if it is over one day, to what an extent is it going to give other candidates unfair advantage, whether is there unfair advantage, or I think those are some of the issues that we would need to discuss. You are noted, honorable members. I generally think that, while I'm being unfair to you, Ms. Silkstone, something has just crossed my mind. When I was in the committee 11 years back, there were tensions between the public protector and the deputy public protector. I think also we should be looking at the level of a person's emotional intelligence, the ability to lead downwards and the ability to lead upwards. Because sometimes you can have a person who can supervise, but if you have to deputize, you must have an ability to develop a relationship with your supervisor. So you lead downwards and upwards. And I think we should, although maybe I might not have the appropriate method, maybe we can think about it, also generally to test the person's leadership ability. Because some leaders are technically strong, and because they lack leadership ability, and then they collapse the whole organization. So you need to balance those things out. And I think that is what ultimately we will be judged as a committee, whether we have been able to appoint a person who will be able to lead the organization whilst ensuring that also the product that comes out of the organization is a good product. The investigations are properly done, but also while being in a position to motivate colleagues to be able to work properly. So our assessment, whether we have succeeded or not, will not sometimes be clear in the first month or so, but it will be for the duration of that person's occupation of office that we will be judged whether we have been able to appoint a person who is suitably qualified to be the Deputy Public Protector. And I think it was just a thought that was pricked by the discussions that we have had today. Honorable Soso?
No, I agree that leadership skills are very important, and we can certainly add something that tests around leadership skills. I know that people often conflate leadership and management skills. They're different things. And so it is very important. You need somebody who can really, who can contribute to the organization rather than, we don't want a situation where we have people conflict between the public protector and the deputy public protector. And we've had it many times over the years. So yes, leadership skills are very important.
Number of days and the number of people to be shortlisted, I think that this will be our decision. And I think people who were there in the last interviews can also be of assistance to say which areas do we need to improve. I mean, I can see Honorable Breitenbach is not happy with the one day. But it would be important to also answer the question whether if we have it over a number of days, it will not unfairly prejudice other people. Because I think it will be televised, it will be live. If we ask the same questions, other people might have an opportunity to prepare better. How can we mitigate against it? If we can mitigate against that, I think I'll be fine. Honorable Breitenbach, Honorable Horn, Honorable Ngonor, Honorable Jele, Honorable Mohammed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was on the ad hoc committee that appointed this public protector. Let me hasten to say that we were the only party that opposed her appointment. The interviews were done over, I think, 2 days. Well, it took 2 days. It went from the one day to the next day. On a continuous basis. So we started early in the morning and we finished early the next morning. In my view, that prejudiced the candidates who came last. A, they were tired. B, we were tired, very tired, and became quite ratty. So the people who were doing the interviews were not the same people who started early in the morning. We were tired, we were irritated, we were cold, it was in the winter. It certainly, I don't think, was the best way of dealing with the matter. The candidates were supposedly locked away so that they wouldn't have the advantage of seeing other candidates' interviews. That, of course, became quite farcical because everyone's got a telephone. You can't take away people's telephones. And it was, everyone's got a smartphone, and so everybody live streamed the interviews. And so it was a complete and utter failure in what we were attempting to do. I don't believe that it was to the benefit of anybody, not the people who were doing the interviews, and certainly not the people who were being interviewed. You know, the JSC interviews are live streamed. I sit on the JSC. The candidates come over a period of a week. They see how the interviews are conducted, if they so wish. It is my view that each person prepares for an interview differently. And seeing other people interview doesn't necessarily improve your ability to be interviewed. And so I'm also not sure that that you should be allowed to ask a wide variety of questions completely random. That probably isn't fair. But you know, we have last time we had a question sheet, and you could pick questions that you wanted to ask. And we should perhaps look at doing the same thing again. But you know, the fact that our interview.
Can you repeat that one about the questions?
Last time we had a prepared question sheet, and we divided the questions up. so that the same questions were asked. But, you know, it doesn't matter how many times you watch me being interviewed. When your turn comes to be interviewed, you may do so much better than me, despite the fact that you watched me. You may also do so much worse than I did, despite the fact that you watched me. It's a personal thing. Each person interviews personally and differently. And each person brings their own attributes to the interview. And so I don't think there's anything to be gained by doing what we did the last time, locking people up, sitting throughout the night. It was completely pointless. It achieved, in my view, nothing. Certainly didn't achieve what we set out to achieve. All it did do was achieve the interview period being done in the period of 24 hours. I don't know if that's a goal that we should be striving for. I see no profit in it. I would also like to suggest that we keep the interview list, the short list, short. Otherwise, we must call it a long list. But if we go to shortlist, we must shortlist. We must take the best candidates and interview them. There's no point in interviewing 26 people for a job. And I would like to suggest that we keep the list to between 6 and 8. If you can't find a deputy public protector between the best 6 to 8 people on the list, then there would be no point in interviewing the rest of them. We need to do the shortlisting procedure rigorously and with a lot of attention to detail, and then interview as short a list as possible to make the interview procedure as effective as possible. But I would like to urge us to not step in the same trap. There was absolutely no profit, and I'm sure the Honourable Horn would agree with me. He was also on that ad hoc committee, that there was nothing, no quality was added to the process by locking people up, trying to prevent them watching the interviews. It failed miserably in that regard, and I don't believe that the process ended up being fair, because the candidates who came last were tired. They'd been sitting up the whole day. If you're sitting waiting for an interview, you're not going to have a nap. So they were tired, we were tired, we were irritable. The quality of the interview conducted last was certainly not the same as the quality of the interview conducted first, and there's no way to avoid that. We're just people. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. I'm covered.
Thank you very much. I think it's a high standard that if you are covered, don't repeat yourself.
No, I would say, Chair, for the first time, I agree with the Advocate Breitenbach. But Chair, I wanted just to... but I would say, Chair, the aid will be fine. But the bigger question to such is that how do we arrive at aid? This is what has been presented to us as a very proper and appropriate criteria to look for a deputy public protector. So if in our selection process we use this as part of the important instruments to ensure that we do the selection towards the 8 people. Two, Chair, is the issue of days, which I think, Chair, I equally agree that it is an injustice both to the interviewees and the interviewers to have a very stringent interview that sits the next morning to the next morning. The issue is very critical and of paramount importance, such that would need to be in a sane mental state to deal with it. So Chair, on the issue of days, regarding the number of 8, I would wish maybe to give it to the Chair to check the feasibility of finishing one day, to check the feasibility of having a two-day session. But equally, Chair, I want us to look into the nature of the questions. How will we structure the questions? So that the first who has been interviewed must not cause injustice or unfair advantage to the last one that is going to be interviewed. Remember, you have said here the interviews are going to be of access to the public. Therefore, how we structure our questions would be very important. Maybe we say, Chair, we have structured questions to all there. Because how we measure them must be on the basis of equal attendance to them. Where the structured form of questions where we ask, remember, maybe, Chair, I'm not sure which one would be the best practice. Maybe a candidate will come and present for 3 minutes, then we follow with questions, structured questions, equal questions, same questions. Two, maybe we allow members to have maybe not more than two questions from the information we have as per that candidate. So that we at least we don't make it a stereotype process, but because we're looking for leaders. And equally, we don't prejudice other candidates. So I would want to suggest that way, Chair. Thank you very much.
Honourable Mola. Honourable Chala.
Thank you, Chairperson. I think I disagree with her on the point of saying you can look at this person being interviewed and ask the same question and it won't do anything to the next. It depends what to that person, how he's going to respond. I can disagree because if that person, if you're looking at this person answering questions and you are going to get those questions, it can make you at least make yourself prepared, you know, for your next turn. I disagree with that one. Even if we are not capable, the same capable, but it can make the other person who's coming after give that person an advantage. Chairperson, I would suggest that maybe if we are taking eight, if we support the notion that we take eight, time allocated to the candidate in terms of answering the questions will be very important, so that we check if maybe that time won't overlap to the next day. If we can allow our secretaries to do that for us. Then I agree with this one, the eight, and then it can be one day. But I don't know one day eight, how possible is that? Because I think the experience of Honorable Day helped us in terms of saying we ended up all of us tired. Even us ourselves getting tired, asking one question, you know, and all that. So let's check time, and then also that eight is fine, but 2 days, yeah. It won't be possible for one day. I also agree. Thank you.
Thank you. Lastly, Honorable Nevot Kahan.
Thank you, Chair. To be more explicit, no, we would support the notion of eight candidates. Let me just make this point, Chair. You know, there's a number of court judgments that in HR that reflects on or guides us on rational shortlisting, as we have seen when matters are challenged. And we, our debate here is a correct one. You set, as a panel, you set a particular criteria. Numbers follow criteria, logically. And once we have set that, we're in good stead. So we would support that. Coming to the questions, has been raised. I think consistency, we support what Honorable Breitenbach says. There should be consistency. Obviously, there's another criteria set by the courts also, and based on fairness. So, and then if we normally, you would at this level, you would have an hour in terms of time allocated. I would support that, which includes perhaps a 5 to 10 minute presentation. Of how that candidate perceived the Office of the Public Protector would be a broad one, just to get a feel for the candidate itself. And then when it comes to questions that we are located, depending on how many of us there on the day, that we, on the morning, consider allocating the questions to ourselves, whichever questions we have. That would be more, we wouldn't be confused, we know exactly who's going to ask what, and there will be consistency. The rest on the logistics, Chair, we leave it to you. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. I've been looking at the discussions. I don't want it to become personal, but it's hard for me. I'm a deaf person. I don't listen with my ears. I listen with my eyes. So I cannot rest. So if it's a 24-hour interview, I will not be able to close my eyes or get tired, as well as the sign language interpreters. They become mentally and physically exhausted if they have to go for a 24-hour period. Secondly, if it's a two-day interview, can we categorize the question? So, for example, categorize into themes. So if you're talking about teamwork, for example, but you don't ask the same question, it's still linked to teamwork, but it's not verbatim the same question to each candidate. Maybe we can categorize the type of questions and ask on that basis if it's a two-day interview. Thank you, Chair.
Thanks, Chairperson. I just want to know out of the panelists, is it consisted of 11 full members, or is it include also the alternative members? Because we are 11, so because also it will also determine in terms of the time consumption. How many members are there going to be in panel? Is it the whole 11 of us plus the alternative, or only the full-time members? Thank you.
Ms. Silkstone?
I just want to say around the interview, I mean, possibly we could think about, if you're worried about fairness, okay, first going back to the appointment of the public protector and that process, it was extremely long. And, so I would suggest that we don't try and hold everything over a day. Also, even if we have a smaller number of candidates, it really puts the committee under pressure. So it means that if we start running late, you don't have a time to really have a break. And that's sometimes necessary just to get up and walk around. Then in terms of the interview and fairness, I mean, if we've already decided on the broad criteria that we're going to be testing people on, then we just let people know that they must be prepared to answer questions around their experience, their knowledge, their values, their skills, and so on. So it's not about taking people by surprise. We want to know about this person. Is this person the right person for the job, for the position? So, yeah. I think there are ways of getting around things, and Mr. Nivedrukhan's suggestion about having sort of categories of questions with maybe different ways of phrasing or retesting different areas, that can also be done.
I think we do agree on 8 shortlisted people. I think we do also agree that we can have the interviews over 2 days. The question that was asked by Mr. Laoz, I would subject to the advice from the Secretariat on procedural issues, but I would imagine that we must stick to the 11 members of the committee, not the alternates. We stick to the 11 members of the committee, because if you are going to also include alternates, it adds to the time that you would have. Then instead of 2 days, then you will have 3 days, depending on how many people then do come and being part of the panels. And also with alternates, because they are members in other committees, you can have a situation where you start with a panel of 15, then because of other pressing matters, you end up with a panel of 11. That can also create problems. So I would suggest that let's stick to the 11 members of the portfolio committee who will be panel members. And then lastly, I think there's still some time. We will
perfect and take other suggestions that we have made into consideration. So between now and by the time we have the interviews, we will come back to update members, and so that we take this journey together. So that by the time we start with the interviews, we are all on the same page. And on the day of the interviews, an hour or 30 minutes before, we will take the members through the questions that we would have developed. Is that agreeable, members?
Yes.
Thank you very much. Can we have a 5 minutes comfort break so that we can start with the... Yes.